It struck was certainly efficient, because Neil and I had been running around from system to system for the last 50 years or so. We had not had much opportunity to stop anywhere and stock up. And in any case, the residents of those systems would not have been happy with us poaching their natural resources. We'd contacted the PAV on the way in. The kindest description I could give for their attitude would be curt. I guess Jacques was right about them. The thought made me sad, overall. We hadn't been having a lot of luck with alien species. Between the others, the PAV, and the Deltans, I was starting to wonder if it was outright impossible for mutually alien intelligences to get along. And if the local area was at all representative, there must be a lot of intelligences out there. Eventually, we'd run into another star-faring species with a technological advantage. That made war and possibly the extermination of humanity statistically inevitable. I shared my thoughts with Neil, who was, as usual, draped over his chair sideways.
"Geez, Hirsch, that's gloomy even for you. You need a new hobby. Or a hobby at all."
"Hardy har. But what's wrong with my logic, Neil?" He sighed and was silent for a few mils.
"Nothing, I guess."
"So what do you want to do about it? We're still pond scum."
"Nah.
We haven't been that for almost 80 years. We own and operate the biggest damned cargo ship in human space. We are personally responsible for setting up at least 5 colonies. I think we have some street cred."
"Yeah, I guess so," he replied.
"And please don't take that as permission to do a Picard impersonation. I don't think I can take it anymore."
"You got it."
"So what can we do with all that cred?" Neil pursed his lips and stared into space.
"To be honest, my first thought when we got word about this windfall was to double our mover plate count and accelerate to beat hell for somewhere interesting.
Like Ikan Day and Phineas?
And at least a dozen others.
A lot of bobs are just taking off, Hirsch.
Seems kind of, I don't know, self-absorbed.
I was thinking more like trying to place a human colony well outside of human space.
In case you turn out to be right."
I gave him an apologetic shrug. "We still have all the stasis pods from the Great Exodus. There's simply never been any reason to offload them anywhere. And that's the thing. There's no more reason for the pods. Or for the Bellerophon, really. We're obsolete.
So to make ourselves relevant again, we try for another colony. And if we use the ore to add another 32 plates, we'd be able to push some really stupid G's,"
Neil said, warming to the subject.
"So a human colony out in, say, the Perseus arm would ensure continuity even if the rest of humanity ran into a bigger, badder others."
I nodded.
"Now all we have to do is figure out how to locate some volunteers."
5. Investigation. Bob, November 2332, outskirts, Eta Leporis. A cloud of wreckage slowly revolved around a common center of mass. Some of it was recognizable, most was not. I was a little surprised that there was much of anything. I wouldn't have expected a laser to leave much more than slag. Of course, I was assuming that whatever attacked Bender used the same techniques as the drones that attacked my scouts. I would know more once I arrived. It didn't make sense to have the drones try to collect all the detritus and bring it to me. That would take too long and carried too much danger of losing or further damaging something. Instead, I'd fly in with my complement of roamers and do a close-up inspection. But first, I set the exploration drones to watch for any approaching boojums, even though it seemed unlikely that they'd take a sudden interest after letting the wreckage drift unmolested for so long. The fact that the wreckage was drifting away from the system was probably relevant, but if I'd triggered any alerts with all the activity, they might change their mind. I fully admit that I crossed the distance a lot more quickly than I should have. Caution for the moment was taking a back seat. Fortunately, I didn't run into boojum pickets. Even more fortunately, I didn't run into an asteroid. I set the roamers loose to examine the wreckage. It quickly became obvious that what I'd suspected was true. An internal explosion had ripped Bender's ship apart.
Most likely, the laser had taken out the nuclear reactor control system in such a way as to make the reactor fail catastrophically. I remembered my first encounter with Medeiros in Epsilon Eridani so many years ago. He'd suffered that very fate. In addition, the meltdown had taken out his matrix. I had to hope that Bender hadn't come to a similar end. It was an entirely different ship design, of course. Medeiros was riding a military ship designed by the Brazilian Empire. They considered even their human soldiers expendable, never mind a replicated intelligence. Bender was riding a ship that I'd redesigned with special attention to keeping the replicant matrix safe. This bit of simple self-interest gave me hope. Outside inspections complete, the roamers entered the section of ship. I had multiple windows up trying to watch everything at once. Finally, I gave up trying to maintain my VR. I dismissed my library and frame-jacked. Now I could keep up with everything, and putting up with naked floating data windows was a small price. One of the roamers bleeped for attention. I turned to the window and would have smiled if I currently had a body. The roamer had found the replicant matrix containment in the most heavily armored section of the ship, and no obvious damage. Then elation was replaced by horror as the roamers opened the containment to find it empty. No, not empty. Worse than empty. Not only was the replicant matrix missing, but all of the interface hardware had been carefully removed, probably as a unit. This was not good. Someone had made a point of removing Bender and his support hardware in a way that implied an intention to study and possibly revive him. I remembered Homer and cringed at the specter of Bender, helpless and subject to torture. One thing was for sure, though, the Boojums or their makers knew that someone else was around. Having found Bender's empty ship, I had now flip-flopped from panicked rush back to paranoid caution. I wasn't going to hurry anything. I wasn't going to take any chances on attracting the Boojums or, well, running into an asteroid. The flight back to the auto factory area would take most of a week. I had one quandary to deal with, meanwhile. Would I make an announcement now or wait until I knew more? Could I even keep quiet for a week? For that matter, would Will be able to keep his trap shut? I hadn't actually asked him to, although I was sure he would wait rather than steal my thunder. Screw it. I pulled up my console and began writing a blog entry. I had a large following anyway, being the first Bob replicant, and I could be pretty certain that Luke and Marvin would be watching every post. It took a few full seconds of thought to get the tone right. Cautious optimism mixed with a realistic appraisal of possible issues. Hope, but be prepared. Finally, it was done. I hit post, then sat back and waited. 3, 2, 1. Luke, Marvin, and Bill popped in at the same time, all talking at once and waving their arms. I turned in my office chair and waited until the noise died down. "Why, yes, I'm free right now. Come on over," I said. "Bite me," Marvin replied. "Where is he?" "Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it?" I materialized chairs for everyone, and Jeeves entered with coffee. "Damn it," Marvin muttered. "Damn it, damn it." "What's the next step?" Luke asked. "Do you have a plan?" "Nothing concrete yet. I guess the first step is to find the Boojum base, or source, or whatever. There's a good chance Bender will be there. Hell, we can just fly in and sudar the hell out of it if it comes to that. Locate Bender's matrix, then go from there." "A raid?" "If that looks like the best plan." I stuck my chin out. "If someone has kidnapped Bender and is experimenting on him, I'm not sure diplomacy will be my first choice." "Easy there, Bob," Bill said. "Let's see what we find before we start building bombs, okay?" "Yeah, I know. Don't worry. I'll be circumspect." There followed one of those silences where no one quite knew what to say. Finally, Marvin nodded, and he and Luke stood. They gave me a wave and popped out, which left Bill.
"So, number two, what's up?"
"Oh, ha-ha, listen. I wanted to ask you just how you plan to go in-system looking for the Boojums and how public you're going to be about it."
"Public? What the F? Are you saying there's any question?"
"Of course not, Bob.
Not from me or any of the others in our generation, but Starfleet is agitating."
"Starfleet?"
What?
Bill sighed. You still haven't read my blog yet, have you?
No, sorry. Been busy.
Remember Morlock? We're calling him and his group Starfleet now because of their obsession with the Prime Directive. It's become gospel to them. They don't even want us to keep interacting with humans. They're trying to generate support for a formal declaration of some kind that you should leave whatever you find alone.
Is a formal declaration anything like a law?
Bill snorted.
We don't have laws.
But if enough people got together, they could apply social pressure of some kind.
What, like shunning?
Well, something like that in principle.
A loss of prestige, anyway.
For God's sake, Bill. Original Bob never gave even a small fraction of a rat's ass about that.
Yeah, I know, but more and more Bobs are becoming less and less Bob-like.
I'm starting to call them replicants, in fact, instead of Bobs, just to make the distinction.
And they're more concerned about prestige?
Given a random walk, you can't very well drop below zero rat's asses, but you can increase the value arbitrarily. So, yes, we're getting more replicants who are, for want of a better word, joiners. They're forming mutual interest groups for all kinds of things, like Starfleet and the Borg.
Mm-hmm.
And the Skippies.
Skippies? Skippies?
I could feel my eyes bugging out even in VR.
What, they've changed their avatars to beer cans and started calling people monkeys?
Bill snorted his coffee and had to take a moment to compose himself.
No.
It's the group trying to build the Matryoshka brain, you know? Singularity, super AI, and so on. I don't know who started the nickname, but the Skippies haven't complained yet. They also, by the way, want us to leave the humans alone. But in their case, it's because they think the humans are holding us back from our destiny or some such.
Are there any other... No, never mind. I'll read your blog.
God damn it. I go away for a few decades and the whole place falls apart.
I grinned at Bill.
I have some catching up to do, apparently.
There's an understatement. Let me know if you need anything.
Bill gave me a nod and popped out.
Interesting times indeed.
6. The Search Expands.
Bob, May 2333, outskirts Eta Leporis. I sat in my library, blearily gazing at the table in front of me. Will, Bill, and Garfield watched me silently, the occasional slow head shake the only commentary offered. Every once in a while I took a half-hearted sip of my coffee. Bill finally couldn't take it any longer.
You do understand you're invert, right? You can just dismiss the hangover, right?
I responded with a pasty half-smile that was probably more terrifying than reassuring.
Yeah, and in the future I'll do just that. There's no metric in which this is enjoyable, but after finally reading your blog, well,
Original Bob was by no means an alcoholic, but he did occasionally, when it was called for, go on,
Bender, did you make that whole speech just to deliver that line?
I chuckled, then groaned and held my head.
No, it was just a bonus, but God damn it, Bill, we are diverging.
Nothing bad yet, but I think you're right in expecting it.
And we actually have a Bobby now?
That's just a rumor. I don't know of anyone who's met her, but really, that's inevitable too. I sighed and considered doing a reset and dismissing the hangover. It had served its purpose, whatever deep psychological need for self-flagellation was involved, but now my curiosity was up.
This feels pretty real. Verisimilitude in VR, vert, has really been improving.
Part of that's the manis, of course, Will said from across the room where he was nursing a soft drink. Once we started experiencing things in real again, we realized how granular and synthetic the vert experience actually was.
It helped that humanity was back on its feet by then. We had actual experts to ask about some of the finer points.
Bill waved his cup in a vague, out-there gesture.
Like Bridget, for instance.
She's ferociously competent in the biological sciences and naturally highly motivated now to help with the improvements. And with SUDAR scans, we can accurately map how the human body and brain respond to various stimuli, like taste and other senses. And hangovers? I grinned, then winced again. She and Howard live almost full-time in Real, right?
Yep.
And raising kids as well. I've lost count of how many they've adopted over the years.
Well, here's something to chew on,
Garfield said. He'd been silent up to this point, so we all turned to him.
And it's important if you want to maintain perspective on your place in the cosmos.
He paused for dramatic effect.
As replicants, we never get tired. We have near-perfect memories. We can process hundreds of times faster than humans. And we have instant access to all the information available in our archives. But we aren't any smarter than original Bob was. And reading about something isn't the same as being trained in it. You can't become a doctor by reading Grey's Anatomy, for instance. Or watching it.
I frowned.
Okay, I get that in principle, but how is it important? We can't do everything ourselves. For instance, without Bridget, the androids wouldn't be anywhere near as advanced as they are. We've improved our weapons by talking to military types.
Or stealing from them, I interjected. Garfield glared at me for the interruption.
We've become a sort of society unto ourselves, but for the most part we're still doing the things original Bob was interested in. We're a monoculture, specialists, and that's not healthy.
So, you're saying, Bill raised an eyebrow at him,
that I'm not sure replicative drift is a bad thing, necessarily.
Gar, I don't trust some of the new replicants, Bill said.
Nor should you. They're different people. But the Bobiverse needs to be robust enough to handle a society where not everyone's priorities align. Sure, we need to be more worried about security and such. How is that different from locking your house or your car, though?
That does it, I said. This conversation is incompatible with a hangover. I did a reset and felt better immediately.
Does this mean we'd accept other humans as well?
Bill shrugged.
We've always been willing to do that, but we've gotten no takers, at least none who've decided to deal directly with us. Those that have chosen to go with replication have signed with companies that offer shared processing in a large computer facility. The bigger the monthly fee, the more processing power and extras you get.
There are options like Manny connection ability, and even premium Manny models available only to the highest paying clients. Most of them, though, are just spending their afterlives engaged in full-time vert.
That doesn't make sense. This is freedom. The best kind of freedom, where you can do what you want with no reliance on anyone else.
Not really, Bob. That sounds good to a loner like original Bob, but to a lot of people it would be the opposite of attractive. Among other things, self-reliance means having to be responsible for everything yourself. Much easier to just pay someone to take care of the details, if you have the money. And remember, this is immortality for a copy of you at the expense of permanently destroying original you. Bill paused, then shrugged in dismissal.
On the other hand, there has been a lot of interest in post-mortem corpuscle storage in Real, and in fact, companies have been springing up all over the colonies, offering to warehouse people after death, just like with original Bob. Except now, they use stasis pods, so there's nothing irreversible about it. And they're doing a booming business.
Because when you come back, it'll be original you. Yeah, much more attractive option. Will sighed. Except for people like Justin, who have a religious objection. We commiserated in silence for a mill. As the face of Bob, Will had been especially close with our relatives for decades. Julia's death, then her son Justin's, had hit him every bit as hard as Homer's.
Bill continued, and it doesn't help that for years we were rushing all over the galaxy saving humanity's butt, dying in space wars, and generally acting as dragon fodder. The idea of being a replicant never really recovered from the negative perception of ending up as a disposable servant.
Garfield pointed a finger at me by way of emphasis.
Don't forget, too, that the governments of the day were characterizing replicants as non-human copies, automata, no rights, and so forth. A lot of that stuck. I nodded.
And are they bringing any back?
The corpsicles, I mean.
Yes. A significant number have been revived when their condition became curable, thanks in large part to Howard and Bridget's Cancer Foundation. Most of the remaining corpsicles are up against the limits of gerontology. They still haven't conquered aging. At some point, replacing cloned organs becomes a game of whack-a-mole, and when the brain starts going, well, there's no longer any point. Then there are the other Bobiverse projects. The Skippy's Singularity Project makes a certain amount of sense, but some of the others? I paused.
Silkies? Like Van Vogt's Silkies? Jaegers? Space Dragons?
Garfield laughed. Remember when Marvin was trying to replicate the setting for every book he'd ever read in VR? Turns out he was thinking too small. The groups you're talking about are trying to replace our standard spaceship hulls with something more, imaginative?
We've been making glib comments about being Homo Sidereia now. I guess some Bobs have taken the concept and run with it. Bill grinned.
I've subscribed to their blogs. It's harmless stuff. The Singularity Project may be slightly less so. Starfleet, a lot less so, especially if they decide to do more than just talk.
This last comment cast a pall on what had been a very interesting conversation, and an uneasy silence reigned for several mils.
I finished my coffee with a final gulp. Time to get down to business.
Very interesting, but speaking of interesting, there's the small matter of a mega structure or something to look at, shall we?
Hear, hear, Bill said, and I transferred us all to the control room. Invert, it was nothing but a change of visuals, but original Bob had always been obsessive about detail, and we early generation replicants shared that attitude.
The control room had wall screens and consoles with a very science fiction, spaceship-ish tone. The only proper venue for exploring a new stellar system.
So, what do we have? Bill said, stepping up to the holotank.
The ballistic scouts will have completed their sweep through the inner system, and we should have a complete picture, I said.
System planets first, Guppy.
Bill, Will, and Garfield all glared at me in tandem. I was stalling.
They knew it. I knew they knew it, and so on, but my VR, my rules.
The holotank showed six planets consisting of three gas giants farther out and three rocky planets considerably farther in, with one in the habitable zone. The large gap between planets two and three was glaringly obvious.
That spacing doesn't look natural, Bill said.
I nodded. Way too asymmetrical. Either planets have been moved to make room for the megastructure, or planets are missing.
The Booja makers will most likely have originated from the second planet, Will said. What do we have?
No chlorophyll lines, minimal oxygen lines, no radio traffic, no indication of organics at all.
We turned to stare at Guppy. The last time we'd seen a planet with those characteristics, it had been Pav. Afterward.
The others?
Isn't this outside their range?
Others' attack is unlikely. Sudar readings indicate significant metal concentrations.
Good. If the others had hit this system, the metals would have been mined out. Let's finish looking at what we've got, then unless there's a good reason otherwise, I'll send some scouts in under power to get a close-up look.
I turned to Guppy. Smaller bodies?
None. This system has been swept clean.
What? Not even moons?
No moons.
Wow, Bill said. Someone has been busy.
Let's set that question aside as well, Will said. Right now we have two options. One, we can look at the megastructure data, or two, we can beat the crap out of Bob.
Can we do both? Bill asked. I grinned at them.
My money's on a Dyson swarm.
Pretty thin one, Bill said. No solar shading at all.
Beat the crap, Will growled.
I laughed. And now the moment we've all been waiting for. I nodded to Guppy and he updated the holo image.
We stared. For what might have been entire seconds.
Finally, Will said,
"What the actual fuck?"
Bill flickered for a moment as he frame-jacked, probably checking the archives. He was back before I could react. Topopolis.
It looks like spaghetti, Will said, or a wire sculpture.
I checked the schematic on the monitor.
That is one continuous cylinder, 56 miles in radius, stretching three times around the star, wound around itself in a sort of helical shape.
Taurus knot, Bill interjected.
How is that even possible? Will asked, ignoring Bill's correction.
Bill shrugged.
It was discussed back on Earth in original Bob's time. There's relatively little information on the concept. Apparently, it wasn't as popular as O'Neill cylinders, Stanford Torii, and Bishop rings, but it doesn't require particularly advanced technology, just large-scale effort and brute force engineering.
What about gravity?
It's essentially an O'Neill cylinder millions of miles long. It spins around the minor radius to generate artificial gravity.
But it's curved!
Bill smiled at Will's outraged complaint.
Think about the scale, bud.
If the strand has a mile of bend for every million miles of length, you wouldn't even have to put in expansion joints. That's less than a tenth of an inch flex over each mile of length. The structure would flex less than the Golden Gate Bridge when a single pedestrian walks across it.
But where would they get the material?
Oh, Will nodded. Missing planets.
On the grand scale of things, Bill mused, this is less impressive than what the others were trying to do.
Except the Boojum makers didn't invade other systems to get materials.
We don't think, I said, glancing at Bill. I haven't exactly done a survey.
If they don't have subspace and surge drives, it seems unlikely, he replied. But that's another question in abeyance until we have more information. So what's our next step?
Good question, I said.
This shoots down my earlier plan to just scan the Boojum's home base for Bender's Matrix. We can't scan over a billion miles of complex structure looking for one individual cube of optoelectronics while dodging Boojum attacks, especially if the Boojum makers use optoelectronics for their own stuff. It'd be like looking for a specific needle in a haystack where the haystack is all needles.
Yep.
Okay, we'll have to be a little more deliberate with our approach. First, we need to gather information. I ticked off items on my fingers. We want a close-up look at the planet, we want a close-up look at the megastructure overall, and we want a scan of the interior detail.
And we want to not get blown up. That, too.
Bill snapped his fingers.
Speaking of military technology, which we weren't,
Bill glared at me. I've been working on a variant of something I got from the USE. It's a fractal surface that absorbs 99% of radiation that hits it and re-radiates it as infrared. Great for radar, not so good for infrared.
But we have your heat sink idea. Get rid of the heat that way instead.
I nodded. Under power, we'd have a limited time before the heat sink failed. We'd have to choreograph this very tightly.
Yep. So dress up a cargo drone in this fractal surface, complete with heatsink. Fly to planet Boojum, drop off some planetary exploration drones, accelerate for the outer system, and hope to make it out before the heatsink is saturated. Do the same with some high-res drones and drop them off near the structure.
I glanced around the room. No argument was forthcoming.
One last thing. We need more information on Topopolis's...
Maybe there's a human expert on the subject of megastructures. Can someone look into that?
I can do that, said Will, and he popped out.
Bill stood.
I'll get the fractal surface details to you.
He popped out.
I'll work out the drone design, said Garfield, and he popped out as well.
I'll have another coffee, I said to the empty room.
The Autofactory drones had been locating and retrieving raw materials from the Kuiper Belt and Oort Cloud for a couple of years now, so logistics were no longer quite as much of a limiting factor. Bill and Garfield had their info to me within hours, and soon I had my Autofactory churning out modified drones at full speed. Still, there were some significant mods, and the fractal camouflage was a pain to get right. But a week later, I had all my spy devices ready. I double-checked the calculations, sacrificed a coffee, and let fly.
Now we wait, said Bill. Like we haven't been doing that for the last forever or so, Garfield grumbled.
7. Looking forward. Will, June 2333, Vert. The search for information on Topopolis turned out to be one of those good news, bad news things. Good news, I'd found an expert. Bad news, he was dead. Good news, he'd arranged to be replicated. Bad news, he'd gone right back to work and was really hard to get hold of. The whole Keystone Cops Act would be giving me a headache if I were still subject to such things, so I decided to take a break and do some work on a personal side project I had going. I pinged Conan and popped over as soon as I received a response. Conan was the current Bob rep in the Omicron Squared Eridani system. It hadn't been a heavy labor position for a long time, Vulcan and Romulus having long ago become independent of our help, but we had always maintained a physical presence, for our family's sake, if nothing else. I looked around as I settled in. Conan appeared to have replicated the Vulcan jungle with his home in a treehouse. I smiled to myself. I knew enough about Vulcan's wildlife to realize this was completely unworkable in real life. Even without the now extinct Cupid bugs, there was still more than enough variety of the bad kind in the wild to kill any human dumb enough to be out without an exosuit. Conan saluted me with a can of Coke. I sat in the nearest chair and, there being no Jeeves in view, invoked my own can. "What can I do for you, O great ancestor?" Conan said. "Are you one of mine?" I replied, and he nodded. Ancestry had never been a big deal in the Bobiverse, but with all the fragmenting lately, people were starting to pay more attention to chains of instantiation, with an eye to cataloging behavioral DNA. As with a lot of Bob projects, it was ad hoc and casual. "I'm concerned about the family, Conan. Faith has been getting more influential on Romulus the last couple of decades, and that can't be anything but bad news." "I get it, Will, but a lot of people like the sense of certainty that religion gives them, and faith is all about nice, easily packaged, black and white answers, even if they're factually wrong." I waved a hand in dismissal. "I frankly don't care what the justification is. I want our family out from under. We've seen the rise of the far right too many times in the last half millennium to not recognize the signs."
"Okay.
And?"
"I have a small side project going on. I want to set up a society with an innocuous name like Outward Bound or something for people who want to emigrate from this system. If you have the time, I'm hoping you'll take care of the setup and admin." Conan grinned. "This hasn't exactly been a pressure cooker job. Howard started divesting us of responsibility as soon as he could, and we've continued with that tradition. I'm more like a local ambassador than anything. How's that working out lately?"
"Yeah, I'm curtailing my appearances these days."
Conan made a deprecating gesture.
"Bobs are not their favorite people, even on Vulcan, never mind Romulus. So as it happens, I have lots of free time."
"Any specifics?"
"Nothing complex. We just need a legally incorporated society, no special requirements, board of directors, etc. I'll email my family contacts once you have it set up, then we'll go from there."
Conan nodded.
"So you're forming a prospective colonial group composed exclusively of Johansson descendants?"
"Not exclusively, not even predominantly, if we get enough interest, but I want as many of ours out of here as we can manage."
"Faith might step in. They don't have the clout right now, but by the time you're ready to shove off..."
"Yeah, I've been thinking about that too. The constitutional guarantees plus the original documents of agreement they signed with me back on Earth will establish the legal requirement to let the colonists go. We need to be ready, though, if they decide to go for brinksmanship. Let's talk about in-system assets that are still Bob-controlled."
Conan smiled and popped up a graphic, almost as if he'd been expecting this.
8. Survey results. Bob, July 2333, outskirts, Eta Leporis. Will, Bill, and Gar were in attendance in anticipation of some useful returns from our scout drones.
Orbital mechanics being what they are, the drone destined for planet Boojum arrived first. We were a little concerned about the possibility of deceleration attracting attention from the Boojums, but finally decided that A, there was no reason to expect them to be more interested in powered objects in particular since they'd cleared the system of everything, and B, we didn't have much choice. In any case, the drone settled into a low orbit around planet Boojum with no issues or incidents and ejected all its scouts. It was immediately obvious why there was no sign of life. This was a dead planet, and not by natural means. The panorama below us combined the worst of an other's attack with Earth's fate at the hands of humanity. There had very clearly been an exchange of nukes. Blackened, blasted circles where cities might once have been were still putting out enough radiation to forestall any possible misinterpretation. Impact craters indicated at least some orbital bombardment, although nothing as big as what the Brazilian Empire had used on Earth. The planet hadn't spiraled into nuclear winter, but even so, there was no indication of living vegetation. Large swaths of what might once have been forests were burned to the ground, with not the slightest trace of new growth. Finally, I reached forward and turned off the big monitor. I said to Guppy, "Let me know if anything anomalous shows up. Otherwise, record and archive everything, then recall the scouts and leave the drone in orbit for now."
"Acknowledged."
I pulled up the data stream from the other cargo drone, which was slowly pulling up to the megastructure. The scale of the thing was such that you could only see one thread at a time. The other two loops were so far away as to be invisible. "So, what I want to do," I said, "is spread the SUDAR scanning drones along the length of the megastructure so that we get a full scan of a long segment with enough overlap so we don't lose any detail. I'm going to assume that whatever stretch we pick at random is going to be representative of the structure as a whole."
"Seems reasonable," Will replied.
We settled back to wait for the drones to reposition themselves. I still had some concern about the Boojums. They hadn't bothered us yet, and we had some pretty good countermeasures for non-SUDAR detection methods, but I didn't know if they might have an A-game or something for guarding the perimeter of the Topopolis, although common sense would tell you to keep watch farther out and not let anything get this close in the first place. Anyway, the drones reached their assigned stations without any fuss. Bill and I gave each other simultaneous thumbs up. This was the moment of truth. "Okay, Guppy. Start with full reach scans for each drone, then cut the range in half with each subsequent scan until we're down to a 2-mile range, which should be enough to scan the inside surface. Then start taking snapshots every second until we have a full revolution recorded."
"Acknowledged. Scan results coming up."
"It, doesn't actually look like it's rotating," Will said. "Are you sure about your assumptions?" I grinned back at him. "I did some reading. A lot of the design choices for O'Neill cylinders will apply to Topopolis as well. Chances are there's an outside shell that doesn't rotate. It will be thick and designed to absorb micrometeor impacts and high-energy radiation. You don't want that much mass loading the rotating section, so the much thinner but structurally stronger inner shell will rotate, giving simulated gravity on its inner surface. There will be magnetic bearings or some such between the two shells."
"Say, you know a lot about this thing for not having scanned it yet."
"It's all theory, Bill. Let's see what we've got." I turned to Guppy and nodded. There was no dramatic change to the monitor window, but smaller data windows began stacking up in various locations. We watched the action for a few milliseconds, then I reached over and tapped one of the scans. The window expanded in front of the main monitor, and Bill and I leaned forward to examine it in detail. "You were right about the shells," he said. "Inner one is generating 0.86G. "Which is exactly the gravity on the second planet," I replied. "So that's the Boojum Maker's home world. Air's not even close. Are you surprised? The pounding, the fires, and no life to provide homeostasis, nothing could live on planet Boojum the way it is right now."
"I guess not.
When will we be able to get a detailed scan of the inhabitants?"
Not until we're down to the rotational snapshots. Let's just leave it running.
We sat around the control room, variously drinking coffee, beer, or Coke. I looked askance at the glass in Will's hand. He smiled back. Picked up the habit from Marcus. Sometimes something cold and fizzy is a nice change. There was a ding reminiscent of a microwave, and the phrase "scans complete" popped up on the monitor. We all quickly stood and hurried over to examine the results. The next few seconds resembled what you'd get with any gaggle of scientists trying to outshout each other, but we eventually distilled some useful information. I stared at the hologram of a native. It was more like an other than a PAV in that it didn't closely correspond to any Terran life form that I could think of. Will examined it, head cocked to the side, and declared, "There's a bit of otter in there, I think."
"A flying otter," Garfield blinked. "Or a flying squirrel?"
Flying otter is reasonable if you ignore the head," Will added. "Or maybe giant beaver? Look at the tail. That thing looks like it fans out." We stared for a few more moments. To me, it looked like a 4-foot-tall fat otter, but with a flap of skin around the forearms that could open or close, and a snout that was almost a beak, but with teeth, like something between a platypus and a were-duck. The tail did seem to be able to fan out, or flex flat, or something, going from a roundish appendage to something more beaver-like. The creature was covered with fur, which tended toward a rich chestnut brown.
"Snarks," Garfield said. "If we have boojums, we need snarks to make them."
I held up a hand.
"Sure, but only until we find out their name for themselves.
Assuming we can pronounce it."
"It's aquatic," Bill said after some more silence. "The forearm things and the tail are for pushing through the water."
"That explains the river," Will added, and we all nodded. One of the many interesting aspects of the design was that a river ran the entire length of the section we'd scanned, and that was more than 100,000 miles, or rivers, depending on how you counted. It branched and merged constantly. It was possible that the river system ran the entire length of the Topopolis.
"Interestingly," Will continued, "the way the river loops and splits and meanders, no part of the inner surface seems to be very far from water."
"Given the native's biology," Bill replied, "that was probably a design requirement." We gazed in awe at the pictures and schematics. Then Garfield said,
"Where would you get all the water? The overall structure is literally 1 billion miles long."
Bill froze for a moment, then turned to Garfield. "Earth has, or had anyway, about 330 million cubic miles of water. The river in the Topopolis averages maybe 0.5 mile wide and 1/10 mile deep. So if it was straight, you'd probably only need about 50 million cubic miles to fill it. Soil can also be up to 25% water. So depending on how deep they've layered real soil over the shell's inner surface, maybe you add another 100 million cubic miles. It's still less than what Earth had. And there's always the Oort cloud if you needed more."
Garfield bobbed his head a few times as he absorbed that.
"And the materials to build it?"
"The Earth contains about 90 billion cubic miles of iron. To build this, based on the cross-section we see, you'd only need 20 billion cubic miles. Although, of course, you couldn't use steel, not nearly enough tensile strength. Most of this structure is constructed of some kind of ceramic reinforced by a 3D carbon fiber lattice, similar to what we use for our ship hulls, so even that estimate is probably way high.
But the point," Will added, "is that you can get all the material you need by taking apart one Earth-sized planet."
"Which probably explains the orbital gap between planet 2 and 3, I finished.
"Oomph," said Garfield.
"So what now?"
"Well, we have well-established and tested procedures for picking up culture and language surreptitiously, thanks to Jacques," I said, although he had physical access to bookstores and libraries on PAV. "I'd like to move things along as fast as possible, but without direct access, we're going to be at a disadvantage."
Bill frowned.
"We're going to have to send in spy drones."
I nodded. He had hit the nail right on the thumb.
Yeah, and that's not going to be a trivial undertaking. Then we have to wait until we've absorbed the language and culture before we can go in. Is there an alternative? What about just using spy drones? I mean, for the search for Bender, not just for the cultural absorption. Will shook his head. I can't see that working. They either fly around a lot where they can be seen, which is bad, or they stay in hiding and don't get around much, which is bad. Plus, it becomes very difficult to ask questions of the locals.
Excuse me, sir or madam, Garfield said. I am not alien spy device, despite appearances. Could you please direct me to the nuclear vessels?
We all laughed. Gar's Chekhov impersonation was spot on. After a moment, I nodded to Will. All right, accepted. I know this will sound odd after Bill's comments about keeping a low profile, but I've been talking to some people over at the Singularity Project.
You're talking to the Skippies? Garfield asked.
Yeah, they don't have an AI yet, but they do have a generalized self-programming expert system with enormous processing power. I wanted to be ready to fast-track the language translation and Android design work if we found Sofonts.
Wait, androids, you're thinking way ahead on this, Garfield said.
Bill looked at me with a rueful smile. You're looking for some help from them on that, too? I gave him a tight-lipped smile in reply. They think they can pick up a lot from sudar scans, including possibly sound.
What? How?
It's the same principle as bouncing a laser off a window to pick up vibrations from sounds inside the target building. You demodulate the reflection. Sudar doesn't work that way.
No.
But the Skippies think that they can use it to pick up vibrations from rigid surfaces in the megastructure. Even glass, assuming they have it. That'll be pretty hit and miss. You'd have to do a lot of scanning for the small number of situations where that would be feasible. They're willing to take this on? I nodded. They're isolationist, but not like Starfleet. They don't think contact with humans is a morally bad thing, just that it's holding us back, presumably by forcing us to keep conforming to human culture and so forth, I guess. But they are neutral on the question of interference with any locals, so I figured it would be relatively safe. Of course, if Starfleet gets hold of it, they'll go ballistic. But really, what can they do besides scream loudly? They aren't here. They can't get here in less than a couple of decades, and I have control of the local hardware, so they won't be building local ships or androids. And honestly, Will added, if they started using strong-arm tactics, I don't think it would go well for them. As a group, Bobs aren't tolerant of that kind of thing. They'll register their disapproval, we'll acknowledge their right to their opinion, and that'll be that. Well, we have enough scans for a first pass at a rough android design, but a lot of work ahead of us on the culture and language fronts, starting with how we get in. Yeah, I don't want to cut my way in. To be honest, I'm not sure if that'd even be possible. There have to be some legitimate entrances for supplies or personnel or maintenance equipment or something. Internally, there will have to be a ring of some kind between the inner and outer shells to allow matching the rotation for things going in and removing the angular vector for things coming out, a spin transfer system. We should look for that kind of structure in the scans.
Maybe it's time to just have a detailed look at what we've got.
Several dozen milliseconds later, the party atmosphere had evaporated. A bristling silence hung over the group, and we all wore matching frowns. I presume everyone has noticed the level of technology of the inhabitants.
Or lack thereof,
Bill replied. Garfield poked at a window in front of him. Or the fact that the interior entrance we did a close-up on appears to be sealed off so the inhabitants can't leave. Something smells. We now had a couple hundred thousand miles worth of point scans and a thorough rotational scan from three locations. The results were perplexing. Instead of modern metropolises, we were seeing what appeared to be villages constructed mostly of some kind of wood equivalent, mostly concentrated around the river. Smaller settlements were situated around tributaries and branches. There was very little in the way of metal as well. In fact,
Most of the metal seemed to be in the form of small discs carried around by the locals. Money. I tapped the image to call attention to a detail. We'll need to do some more scans to confirm, but it looks like the land is sculpted rather than the product of any kind of natural erosion. Either the water for the streams and tributaries is pumped up to the source, or they have actual weather to supply the headwaters. Also, Bill pointed out, the inside seems to be divided into segments of about 560 miles in length, separated by mountain ranges that form a ring to divide each segment. He tapped an image and it zoomed. We don't have enough detail, but I think those mountains also anchor stays or guy wires to keep some kind of cylinder lined up down the center of the structure. I'm guessing that central cylinder provides illumination. There's no allowance in this design for letting the actual sun shine in. Probably true, but Sudar hasn't been able to pick up those kinds of detail, and if you're right, it brings up the issue of heat dissipation. I wonder how they handle it. I think we have at least a partial answer to that, I said. There are radiator surfaces along the entire shaded side of the outer shell, which are radiating way more heat than can be accounted for by solar absorption. So there's a lot of heat being generated internally, probably that lighting you're talking about. There must be a system to bleed the heat from the living area to the outer shell. Everyone in the room nodded slowly in appreciation. Bob's loved technical solutions. And notice, Bill added, the river's meandering pattern repeats every dozen segments or so. I think the landscape does as well. I guess they just used the same design templates over and over. They might even have built the megastructure in segments of that size, then glued them together. 1 billion miles, that's almost 2 million segments. We all stared in silence at the data windows for several milliseconds. Maybe, Bill mused, we just happen to have scanned a section of the megastructure that's set up as an agrarian community. There's no reason for the society to be identical along the entire length of the Topopolis. Maybe they're technologically backward by choice. Including blocking the exits? That seems incompatible with a voluntary return to the land, you know. Well, it isn't ideal for first contact or for learning about their society. I tapped my chin for a few moments. Let's move along the strand and see if we can find something more up to date. 1 week later, we admitted failure. We had not only moved millions of miles along the original strand, but we had even jumped to one of the other strands and continued our survey. There's all kinds of variation in detail, I observed, including different climate zones and completely uninhabited areas, but everything is pre-industrial. Why would a species build such an amazing feat of engineering, then sentence themselves to essentially live in a zoo? Maybe that was the point of building it. These are aliens, Bob, Bill shrugged. Their motivations may not be understandable. I've never bought into the idea that aliens will have indecipherable motives, which makes it odd that you feel differently. I smiled at Bill to take the sting out of the comment. Things like curiosity, greed, self-interest, self-preservation, anger, fear, all of these are pretty basic pro-survival tropisms. Sure, but that doesn't make their behavior predictable from our point of view. For instance, a more herd or hive-oriented species might not have greed, or not as much anyway. A more predatory species might consider biting you to be a reasonable response to a disagreement. Xin, I said, grinning. Or Pav, Bill responded. Because of their large family structure, they certainly have a different take on life. But it's comprehensible, isn't it? I argued. We, or humans, might not live that way or want to, but we can understand the motivations of the Pav. Same with Xinti or Klingons. In this case, we think this might be a semi-aquatic species, like beavers or otters. How will that affect their attitudes? Bill shrugged without comment. I was pretty sure I was right, but we wouldn't know until we figured out how to get in. I grinned at the traditional catcalls and jeers as Bill tried to get control of the moot. I noted, though, several pockets of Bobs that weren't participating in the ribaldry. This included a half dozen or so Bobs dressed up as Borg, as well as other groups who mostly still looked like original Bob. This reticence seemed uncharacteristic for Bobs, although I thought the Borg might be just trying to stay in character. As I looked around, I realized that there was a certain amount of miscellaneous cosplay going on. Nothing really out there, at least not yet, I admitted to myself. As replicative drift continued, I expected individuals would become bolder. Bill seemed to have sufficiently dampened the flames of rebellion, and he began to talk. Well, shout. Okay, people, we have an update on the Snarks. I think you'll find this all interesting. We'll also be asking for help from anyone who cares to volunteer. There are some technical hurdles that could use some dogpiling. He waited for the anatomical suggestions from the audience to peter out, then turned and gestured to me. I climbed the podium to more shouted suggestions and grinned at the sea of faces. Those of you who were around for the others' reveal will feel a bit of deja vu, I think, but in this case, we aren't at war, so that's a plus. I waited for the razzing to subside. So, first, here's a native Snark. I autopiloted through the presentation of the megastructure residents while mentally reviewing the upcoming second part of my presentation. As usual, the Bobs were respectful and quiet when interesting information was being presented. Then came the second part. I started with an overview of the Topopolis, during which you could have heard a pin drop. I followed with close-up rotation scans and ended with blueprints of the megastructure entrance mechanisms. As I finished, and my voice petered out, there was a moment of silence, an indrawn collective breath, then pandemonium. Bill laughed out loud as he jumped up onto the podium. Nothing got Bobs excited like interesting new stuff, and nothing felt better than a bunch of excited, enthusiastic Bobs. Even the Borg cosplayers were jumping up and down. "So, here's what we need," I said when the hubbub had died down. "We need a group to work on plans for getting into the megastructure without revealing ourselves. We need a group to work on android design for Snarks based on the scans we have to be improved on once we get close-up scans. We need a group to continue to scan the megastructure to see if there are variations in either engineering of the structure itself or the placement or technological level of the inhabitants or any other variations you might find. It's a billion freaking miles of structure, so the more the merrier. And as an ongoing project, we'll want people to help decipher the language and culture." And more pandemonium. I glanced surreptitiously at the group that Bill had identified as Starfleet. To a man, they were silent, with dour expressions on their faces. "We're in business," Bill said. "More volunteers than available positions. The Skippies have agreed to do language analysis, as you'd hoped. The hardware group that was working on giant robot spaceships has already dropped their project in favor of the android design. Interestingly, the Borg wanted in, too. I think there's something about androids that tickles their fancy. And there's a D&D-obsessed group, calls themselves Gamers, that wants to work on the breaking in thing." "Why?" I asked, frowning. "Don't ask me. By about 20th gen or so, individual motivations stop being predictable, even when they're still mostly Bobs. So Starfleet didn't squawk. I don't think they saw any point. Even if they could have gotten a word in edgewise, they wouldn't have accomplished anything except getting themselves shouted down. But," Bill hesitated, frowned, then gazed at me intently, "that doesn't mean they're just going to fold. Original Bob wouldn't have, so we have to keep our guard up." At that moment, Garfield popped into my library. "Hey, Bill, Bob." He signaled Jeeves for a coffee, grabbed Spike, and sat down with the cat in his lap. Spike, as usual, was purring before Garfield even started patting her. I couldn't help smiling. Original Spike had been like that, the exact opposite of a standoffish, snobby cat. I remembered all the time she would climb me as I sat at my computer, then drape herself across the back of my neck. I'd left that last habit out of the cat's AI. It had literally been a bit of a pain in the neck. Garfield was excited about something.
What? I said. Well, we've agreed we will have to be more careful than Jacques was about the drones. The PAV were truly 18th to 19th century equivalent. If they'd seen something, they would have just assumed it was a bird. The Snarks may have technological age knowledge, even if they don't have the actual tech, for whatever reason. Also, Bill interjected, even if the common folk don't have tech, whoever is still running the Topopolis certainly will. You think it's still being actively staffed? I asked, frowning. Hard to see how it couldn't be. Imagine people walking out of a nuclear power plant for a couple of days.
Or any other similar operation, Garfield said.
I remember life after people, thanks. Bill shrugged, unwilling to be offended. Anyway, the Topopolis is still apparently running like clockwork, so it's being maintained and managed. I guess they could have just handed it over to an AI. I can't see that happening. An intelligent species wouldn't just hand over responsibility like that, Garfield retorted. You're anthropomorphizing. You know Original Bob's view on this. Aliens will still act rationally within the bounds of their environment and biology. Which doesn't mean they'll act like humans or make human... Okay, kiddies, I interjected. Let's save this convo for when we know more. Gar, do your D&D guys have a way in?
Well, a highly theoretical one. We want to see if we can attach a cloaked drone to a boojum without it noticing. If so, we can piggyback in.
We could be waiting forever.
No, some of the surveillance guys found an entrance that's heavily used.
Only one? Across a billion miles of Topopolis?
No, of course not. Garfield frowned at me. There are three on each strand, for a total of nine like this one, but the others appear to be much less busy and more specialized.
I think only the one is being kept at full operating capacity for system patrols.
That seems odd, Bill said. Not really, Gar replied. All the work's been done. The system has been cleared. It's all routine patrols now. I imagine the patrols are scheduled so they do shift changes or whatever when the entrance revolves around to their side.
Bill shrugged and didn't argue the point.
Is the traffic flow predictable?
Yes, it wasn't obvious at first. There are irregular arrivals and departures that masked the scheduled stuff, but eventually we extracted the periodic events from the noise. We just wait for one of the scheduled shift changes and we should be good.
And we'll have contingency plans? Garfield smiled.
Standard practice. Ever since Hal and the others, a dead man's switch has been de rigueur in the Bobiverse.
I don't want to be too destructive.
Thermite in all the right places, Garfield replied. Just enough to melt the drone without continuing down like alien acid blood.
Well, I guess we're set.
I sat back and tented my fingertips.
Excellent.
9. Group Building. Bob, August 2333, Vert.
I looked around at the crowd in my library, uncertain if I should expand my floor space for the occasion. This was enough people to make my VR hardware sweat a little.
Okay, everyone, I said in a loud voice. Let's get started. Everyone knows me, Bill, Will, and Garfield. Guys, these are the people who volunteered their time and or their group's time to help out with the expedition planning. I figured we all ought to get together and formalize things. I motioned to my left, to a Bob with a floppy conical hat perched on his lap. This is Gandalf, representing the gamer group. They have volunteered to come up with a plan for getting some drones into the megastructure and later to get some androids in.
Preferably without setting off alarms, Gandalf said with a grin.
That would indeed be preferable. Are you still leaning toward the hitch-a-ride plan? Gandalf nodded.
Nothing better has presented itself.
I gave him an amused snort in reply, then motioned to the next person, who was wearing a gray nondescript coverall.
This is Hugh, representing the Singularity Project.
I paused, unsure if I'd just committed a social blunder.
It's okay, Bob. We know we're referred to as Skippies. No one's offended.
Okay. Hugh represents the Skippies, who are engaged in trying to build a super AI.
Wait,
Garfield interrupted.
I thought the Skippies went to numeric designations instead of names.
To be more accurate, we've moved away from audio speech in favor of packetized communication, Hughes said. Think of it like converting to sign language as a primary communications medium. Our names are semantically equivalent to IP addresses.
Wow, said Garfield.
But for day-to-day with other Bobs, I go by Hugh.
So you guys aren't against this expedition? Bill asked. I understood the Skippies disapproved of relations with biologicals.
Hugh shook his head. Not in the same way as Starfleet, if that's what you mean. Those guys are wacko. It isn't a moral thing with us. We just think that interfacing with bios is inherently limiting.
Well, sure, we operate on different timescales, but what's the problem?
Hugh grimaced.
Look, Bill, guys, we, all the Bobs, that is, are what's known as a speed superintelligence. We can and do operate at a much higher processing rate than humans. The problem is that we continue to accommodate them. Every time we slow down to interface with them, all the time we spend adapting to their history, timescale, schedules, is wasted time. It also sets psychological constraints on us. If we just let go completely, we could, as a species, experience centuries of internal life for every month of objective time.
The rest of us exchanged glances.
It's not completely wrong, I said, but it assumes that we have a goal of some kind with sufficient motivation to mandate cutting off contact with humans. There really isn't any such schedule or deadline.
No, there isn't. Like I said, we're not wackos, but the inefficiencies add up. It's like taking the long way to and from work every day because you don't feel motivated to figure out the most direct route. You waste a lot of time that could have been put to better use.
I shrugged.
Okay, I don't disagree. I just question your priorities.
Hold on, Garfield cut in. You said it wasn't a moral thing with you. Does that mean you think it is with Starfleet?
Yeah, at least on the surface.
Hugh paused and returned Garfield's gaze.
Those guys aren't Bobs anymore. Somewhere back in their ancestry, someone got a double dose of drift in something, or maybe there's some PTSD from the last common ancestor's personal timeline, maybe from the Others' War, whatever the reason, they've become obsessive about it. It's not an intellectual stance. It's almost vehement-like.
Well, that's not worrying or